and welcome to Minute 102 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me again this week is Father David Mowry, chaplain to the Movies by Minute community. Welcome back, Father David.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is Donald Pleasance Appreciation Week. We are thankful for Donald Pleasance, and we're going to continue talking about a week that is filled with Donald Pleasance.
Chock full of Donald Pleasance.
So Minute 102 begins with Roger picking up a fallen Colin and goes all the way till Henley disagreeing with Roger. So as we discussed yesterday, Colin took a little bit of a fall by the outstretched leg that for some reason he didn't see and took a tumble. As this minute begins, we get to see that he actually picks him up.
Roger is not so much of a monster as to trip a blind man and then just let him fall all the way to the ground. He's just enough of a monster to trip him in the first place. But then he's a gentleman about it to help him stand back up again.
Exactly. And, you know, as we discussed yesterday, you know, the way that Colin falls is a typical acting fall. Roger has to pick him up quickly so that nobody will really notice that he didn't really fall.
Hands out, making sure to keep that moneymaker face from hitting the rough plywood of the stage floor. But Richard Attenborough is a consummate professionalist, right there to help him recover and get him settled back on the bunk.
Yeah. So he basically picks him up, you know, straightens out his, and Roger straightens out Colin's jacket, which I found to be funny, the way that he does that. And, you know, the whole time Henley's just...
Yeah, I mean, the man is blind. He's not a child.
Exactly.
You can let him straighten out his own jacket, man. But that's always a temptation we have when approaching people who have handicaps like blindness or deafness, that we don't just treat them as an adult who can't do something that we take for granted. We treat them like a child. We act as though they don't understand the ways of the world, or they can't do things for themselves. And that kind of infantilization of those who struggle with these kinds of conditions is, I think, a worse imposition than even sticking one's leg out to make a point.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you on that. He basically, you know, pats him on the back and says, sit down. And then I love how he says it was a good try. What does that mean? It was a good try. It wasn't.
Well, I think like we talked about yesterday, he is in escape mode. And so Colin is doing what Roger is asking everyone in the camp to do, to think creatively and try to be clever about getting out of what is seen to be a unfair imposition, a unfair restriction on one's liberty. And so I think Roger is just in a mode of game respecting game here, that he recognizes that Colin is trying to do what everyone's trying to do is just escape, and he's doing what he thinks he needs to in order to get out.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely empathizes with him. There's no question about that. This whole conversation is not, he's not giving him a stern tongue lashing. You know, he's trying to make it all be all right. You know, like you said, it seems like he's, you know, a father talking to a child and trying to tell him, all right, it'll be okay. You'll get out another time. You won't get out this time, but, you know.
Do you think Roger's empathy is tied with the scar by his eye, that he came close to losing his own eyesight, and so he's a little more empathetic to a man who's going blind?
That's a very good point. I didn't think about that. I would actually say no. It probably, I mean, again, we don't know how he got his supposed injury. You know, was it something that happened in his childhood? Is it something that happened when he got shot down? Is it something that happened, you know, when he was being beaten by the Gestapo? I mean, there's so many different mm-hmm. possibilities of what it could be. You know, could it be that he was, you know, holding a pin and almost put it out his eye? I don't know. If that was the case,
I know what it was. Roger was tripped by one of his older brothers, and his older brother didn't catch him as he was on his way down. And Roger hit his eye on the corner of a cabinet or a table or something, and it scarred him permanently. So he knows the power of tripping, but is quick to save someone from fully experiencing the consequences of such a terrible fate.
Right. And at the same time that he hit his eye on the side of the table, there was a sewing pin there that, you know, caused a little bit more damage. So he has a lot more empathy when dealing with sewing pins on the ground.
It's always going back to a pin. There's always a pin involved. Every traumatic moment in my life, there's a pin somewhere. Oh, he's going to need so much therapy.
Yeah. But first, he's got to get out. They didn't have their, you know, camp therapist. There's no therapist in the ex-organization. Yeah, you have your...
Well, and you know, the Luftwaffe had the funds for a therapist to come to the camp, but then there were budget cuts back in Berlin, and those funds got diverted into other projects. And so what are you going to do? It's just you can't provide the same quality of care that POWs in the past were accustomed
Correct.
To.
Correct. And as they say in Shawshank, you know, when you get money, it's used for more guards, more bars, and I'm trying to remember the third thing. There was a third thing that there was also... But not money for the prisoners. Yeah, so at this point, Roger then starts explaining, well, you know, I hate these last-minute letdowns. Everyone does. He's not really stating something here that isn't the obvious. Anyone who's listening to this, if you've ever had a last-minute letdown that you were not upset about, let us know. You know... Most people, if it's a letdown...
I mean,
if
now,
it's
of
a
course,
letdown,
there are always those things... If it's a letdown, are you able to hate it? But, you know, sometimes you're looking forward to something and, you know, say you're going to get lunch with a friend and you know it's going to be a great time. You're going to be able to really get into some deep conversation. It's going to be a 2, maybe 3 hour thing. And then the friend calls the last minute like, I can't make it. This thing came up at work. You know, that's a letdown, but you did just get 2 to 3 hours back. So that's not bad.
That's right. You've got three hours. You can go sit and watch The Great Escape again.
There you go. Perfect. I can think of no better way to spend 3 hours. So that's a letdown, but that's not, you know, sometimes I don't mind those things happening because it does mean, okay, now my schedule's open up. Like, oh, this is kind of nice. Okay, well, now I can do some other things, or maybe I can do nothing because I was planning on not getting anything done during this time frame anyway. So there are certain circumstances in which a letdown could be a positive thing. Escaping a German prisoner of war camp during World War II, however, getting
there.
That's not one of them.
Exactly.
No. Listeners, let us know if your experience is otherwise from your time as prisoners of war in German camps in World War II. But our guess is probably escaping was something you were looking forward
exactly.
to.
Exactly. And it is a pretty big last minute letdown. But I love the fact that you know, Roger says, but I've only just been told. What do you mean you've only just been told? We just saw in a scene, you know, a few minutes ago. That Colin noticed that, you know, that his eyesight's going. So my question is who actually tipped Roger off?
Well, it's Mac's job to know everything. So Mac found out somehow, whoever that worthless forger that Blythe was working with, maybe he overheard.
Was his name Thomas? I'm trying to remember. I talked about it 2 weeks ago. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I guess I won't remember it.
Eagleless. He's one eagle shy of a full uniform. So when Eagleless, you know, misses that detail, maybe he was hanging around in the rec hall and overheard Blythe say
Smith was
out loud.
Smithy.
Smithy. Oh, Smith and Blythe. So Smithy maybe overheard Blythe say, I can't see a bloody thing, or whatever the exact line is. And because... he can't see anything. He doesn't know if there's someone in the room with him or not.
That's a good point.
Maybe that's how it got back to him.
That's a very, very good point. And the thing is that you know, we know that Henley is noticing something's going on. So it's possible that Henley told him. But then there's also the whole idea that Roger mentioned that he's, you know, they knew that Roger was coming to the room, which is why last week there was a point where, you know, Blythe thought that Henley was Roger. So he was expecting him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The question is, what was he really expecting? You know, how did that play out? You know, were they setting a meeting for something else and it just happened to be at this moment, you know, Roger found out about the eyesight issue? Or is it something that, you know, what did Blythe think he wants to come and talk about? Because obviously Blythe set up the whole pin scenario. You know, he knew Roger was
right.
coming. So that's an open question that we'll probably never know the answer to because those minutes, I guess, were cut out. You know, they cut them from the final cut.
Darn those editors.
Yeah, exactly.
The movie was already 3 hours long.
Yeah, it's almost as long as the trip on Gilligan's Island.
Why not another 10 minutes scene to get into the details of how the intelligence is passed around the camp?
Yeah, but then it brings up the question that Mac is so great in his intelligence, but they weren't able to figure out what they were using the potatoes for. You know.
That's not his bailiwick. He has other people looking into the agricultural intelligence.
Apparently.
They're the ones who let him down.
Yeah. Then Roger basically says that it's too risky for you. Now, this is actually a very valid point. You know, he's looking out for Colin here.
Oh, yeah.
And Henley, you know, quips back. Basically, Henley's the one who tries to advocate against it. Colin doesn't really pipe up here to try to, you know, defend himself. It's Henley who's trying to defend him. But he basically says it shouldn't be Colin's decision. Now, you know, we'll discuss this as this minute goes along, but the bottom line is that Henley's wrong here. It shouldn't be Colin's decision, because if people see that someone's a risk to not only to themselves but to the entire escape, there is reason to try to keep them from going. I mean, I would think that for the same reason, you know, Danny is a risk. You know, they actually should have let Danny go out through the wire the night before. You know, they shouldn't. Willie shouldn't have tried to stop him, because if you have someone who's claustrophobic in the middle of, in the middle of a tunnel, that could potentially also be a lot of problem. That caused a lot of problems.
Right. Well, there are several things going on here. I think what's most interesting here is that you, in talking about how Henley is wrong here, it highlights an ongoing theme in cinema of a failure to understand military discipline.
Right.
Bartlett is in charge. He is the decider. He is the one who's making the calls, because he's the commanding officer of this escape. And in military terms, and all of these guys in this camp are accustomed to the military, are used to taking orders. If the commanding officer says this is not happening in military discipline, you go along with that order. Now, maybe because Henley is an American, and you know how Americans are, very pushy, very individualistic.
Yeah, but he's an American.
A little bit of a cowboy.
But he's an American in the British Army or British Air Force.
Details. Yeah, but he's got that whole cultural thing going for him. Maybe that's why Henley feels like he can push back on this a little bit. The other thing that's here is, yeah, what would happen to Blythe if he didn't get out? I mean, certainly the goal of the escape is to make life as difficult for the Germans as possible. And if Blythe escapes, it will not be difficult for the Germans to scoop him back up. He won't make it 10 yards. And we're not talking about someone like Hiltz, who chooses to get recaptured once he gets out. Blythe will be like a babe in the woods. So in terms of serving the overall purpose of this mission, Blythe's escape doesn't do anything to further those mission objectives.
That's true. I definitely agree with that point. But I think
because the alternative is, right, like you do what the commandant says, you just wait out the war as comfortably as possible. Well, for a man who's blind, okay, sounds like the guy in charge of the camp is not going to make Blythe's life a living hell if he stays behind in the camp.
Right. I mean, we know that
he's being treated as an officer.
We know that there are other injured prisoners. I mean, Ramsey himself is walking around with a cane. You know, he got injured apparently, you know, when he bailed out. He injured his leg to a point where he's still walking around with a cane, you know, and he isn't going out on the escape. So it's not as if, you know, Blythe would be the only one to, you know, it's not that everyone's going but Blythe.
Right. Exactly. I mean, we are planning on getting 250 out. Did we establish early in the film how many prisoners there are in total?
The assumption, according to the book, I think there was about 600 prisoners. The movie never established how many prisoners there are, except for the fact that they want to get 250 out.
Yeah, well, I assumed there were more that were staying behind, because the dramatic thing in the movie would be to say we're getting everybody out, which would be, oh, wow, that would be so much, make the stakes that much clearer and make the number of actual escapees not feel as small.
Right. Because
that way, oh, 76 seems like a big number, but compared to 250, if we know that's how many were planned to get out, then 76 is like, well, it's good. Right. Better than zero prisoners escaping, but...
Mm-hmm. Right. Have you ever seen the movie Escape from Sobibor?
I have not.
So
I have to put that on my... Escape
Sobibor.
From Sobibor?
Yes, it's another World War II movie based on a true story of 600 prisoners who planned an escape from a concentration camp. Sobibor was a concentration camp in Poland, relatively not that far from here, from Zagin. Mm-hmm. And there were 600 prisoners, and the plan was to get all 600 out. But then again they're in a death camp, as opposed to this isn't a death camp. You know, if they stay here, they're fine. But in Sobibor, mm-hmm. the idea was to get 600 out, and I'm not going to give it away for you or for anyone who hasn't seen it yet.
Please don't.
But I highly recommend seeing it. It's a movie with Alan Arkin, Rutger Hauer, Joanna Pakula, a few other names of famous actors that are in it. It was a made-for-TV movie that came out in 1987, if I remember correctly. Great movie. Mm-hmm. No question about it. It's also 2.5 hours long, but still worth watching. But there they clearly...
I'll have to put it on my list.
There they clearly state that the plan is to get everyone out, all 600 prisoners. So you're right. Since they say 250 and they don't say, we want to get all 250 out, you know, that would then let us know how many specific prisoners there are. That's a very good point. Basically, they begin the debate. You know, Roger says, nope, it's not Colin's decision. He basically underscores it without having to say it, that as you pointed out earlier, I'm the commanding officer. I'm the one who makes the decisions here, not you. Then Henley goes into a little bit of soliloquy, explaining why he thinks that Roger's wrong. You know, he says, we all know the score here. Well, at least most of us do. I love the way that he says that, meaning that there are a few people here who aren't really living in reality and don't realize that, you know, the whole idea here is to try to get as far away as possible. But most of us are not going to make it. That's what he's basically saying here.
Right, yeah. Yeah, he's saying there are some people who think, okay, this is my ticket all the way out. The goal is to get home rather than the goal being make life as difficult on the home front for the Germans as possible.
Exactly. I love the fact when he says that, you know, Henley jabs his finger. You know, he's like jabbing it into the air by saying that.
He's making a point. He's very emphatic. As Harrison Ford has shown us, a good point goes a long way.
That is very true. You know, at this point, he lays out the whole idea of the starting a new front, you know, to foul up the Germans behind the lines. You know, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But he says, but once we get out that wire and have them looking all over Germany for us. So at this point, you know, you've done that. You've completed that mission, that part of the mission of making them try to, you know, find us. Then afterwards, some of us have ideas of our own. And so Roger then says, you mean like getting home? Hello. I think that's what most people would, you know, that's what's on everyone's mind. Getting home, or at least getting out of the, you know, getting to friendly lines. You know, I think that's more of the idea
here. With so many of these officers in this camp, they've escaped or attempted to escape so many times. I can understand a desire that this time, for sure, I'm going to get all the way out. I'm going to get all the way back home. But by the same token, if you are accustomed to all your attempts being thwarted, I would think that most of the officers would accept the reality of being scooped up once they get out into Germany.
Yeah.
And furthermore, that the point that Henley makes about Roger being marked, I mean, when you first hear it, it's like, oh, that's a good point. Yeah, that Roger is really wanted by the Gestapo. But if you consider the mission objective here, that's exactly the kind of person you want to escape.
Yeah.
Because that means more resources and a higher priority. And they're going to put better people on that. And the Gestapo and the SS will be scrambling all over to look for escaped prisoners instead of paying attention to spies, to resistance movements, to all kinds of other military intelligence that's going on that the Gestapo and SS would otherwise be looking
right.
at.
And then they bring up the whole idea of family, you know, that they want to get back to their families and,
mm-hmm.
you know, and family and children, which at this point, it's interesting that they mention that, because they're establishing here that these are family men. These aren't just 18-year-olds that have joined up and are on their own. You know, these are, you know, during World War II, none of them look 18. You know, they're in their late 20s, early 30s, if not 40s or 50s.
I mean, I think Donald Pleasance can pass for a very spry 19-year-old in this scene, don't you?
Yes, especially
that acrobatics he shows in taking that fall. Only a young man could do that.
That's true. And I would actually even say that he can pass for a toddler here, because he's just sitting and watching two adults have a fight and not.
He looks so dejected on that bottom bunk. I feel so bad for him. He took his shot. He had a plan and it didn't work out. And he's so sad about it. The poor man just wants to get back to his family.
Yeah. I mean, Donald Pleasance was 43 when this movie was filmed, 43, 44, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, He's you can believe that he would be a family man. You know, that's a good example, yes, of someone who could have been a family man at the time. You know, by the way that...
Oh, yes.
And then Roger quips back, well, you know, do you really believe I haven't thought about that too? You know, because Roger also has a family that he wants to get back to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he mentioned a few weeks ago that he's been in prison, I think, nearly, what do you say, three and a half years? I think that's what he says.
And roughly treated.
Well, he would have been treated much more rough. He actually told everyone. So the fact that the Gestapo didn't know, that helps.
Mm-hmm.
And then Henley's response is, oh, I'm sure you have. So... He's being a little cynical with the way that he's responding about that. And then he goes, well, you know, I know Colin has, which is a great way, first of all, to end this minute by him saying that line, but also to point out the fact that, okay, the two of them have bunked together for a few months or whatever it is, and they've had very mm-hmm. deep conversations. They've discussed the fact of,
yeah,
they've discussed their families, they've discussed, you know, where they want to, what their plan is once they get free and things like that. So, you know, just this little line of him saying that he knows that Colin has thought about what he's going to do or that he wants to get back to his family and children is an important aside that's mentioned here, because it explains also why later in the week, when we'll discuss this, you know, Henley offers makes an offer that most people wouldn't necessarily do just for someone that they barely know. So apparently they mm-hmm. do have a stronger connection that has been building up throughout the course of the time that they're here together. So I found that very interesting. So as we mentioned, yeah, this week is you know, Donald Pleasant's Appreciation Week, and you wanted to highlight a different one of his movies every day. So what movie would you like to highlight today?
Yeah, so we're looking at the movies that came out right around this time, just the handful of movies that Donald Pleasance was working on in the mid-60s here. And so the movie today to add to your Netflix queue is Dr. Crippen. Now, there's some disagreement as to when exactly that came out. Wikipedia says 1962. IMDb says 1963. I'm going to count this as a movie that he worked on after The Great Escape. And as with yesterday's movie, The Guest, in this one, Donald Pleasance plays the titular character, Dr. Crippen. It's a movie about the 1910 trial of Dr. Holly Harvey Crippen, who was accused of poisoning, dismembering, and burying his wife before escaping the country with his mistress. And the movie shows the trial of Dr. Crippen and tries to uncover the mystery of whether Dr. Crippen was really guilty of murder or whether there's some other motivation going on here. So it's a nice, tight 100-minute movie, and Donald Pleasance sports an amazing mustache in this film and looks totally transformed. But perhaps he was a little influenced by his turn as Blythe, because he's got some spectacles as well to make sure that his eyesight is not in question for this movie.
I don't think glasses would have helped him in this case either.
Well, you're probably right. But Dr. Crippen is the next thing to add for your Donald Pleasance Appreciation Week viewing.
Wow. You see, as anyone who knows me knows that I see a lot of movies. And so far, you've picked two that I haven't seen, and you've convinced me that they both sound interesting to check out. So I'm going to be checking them out. That's for sure.
Excellent.
So thank you for that, for another suggestion. All right. Do you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
You can find me. I have a little personal website, fatherdavidmowry.com, where I have a blog that I update sometimes. But you can also find my other Movies by Minutes appearances cataloged there. So if you want to hear more of my blathering on various movies, you can find all of those episodes there.
All right. Excellent. In order to contact me, you can send an email to thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our Twitter account is greatescapemxm. Or you can find us on Facebook at our Facebook group, The Cooler. So, until tomorrow, tally-ho!
Tally-ho!